Giles didn't actually meet. Boatmen would have to unload to the towpath from one boat to another by hand. The most precious resource was ownership of the water, and the Birmingham Canal Network was not sharing it with Worcester. In 1815 they finally came to an agreement and built a stop-lock through the bar. Today this stop-lock looks like one of many baffling locks that punctuate the canal. I've always assumed it was some engineering feat about moving water over land, not a solution to a few stubborn men arguing over money. The bar is in part why you can live in the centre of town on a boat. There have always been narrow boats here, many of them fine examples because the basin is a bit of a showcase for narrowboat enthusiasts. Walk under that narrow tunnel and you leave the clamour of Broad Street and step into a rarefied world of polished brass, coal smoke fires, the clank of metal hulls, and old men ready to tell you anything and everything you've ever cared to know about these waters. The basin is a hugely desirable place to moor. Berths rarely come up, and I have a feeling that once you've mastered the impossible bidding system that secures you one, you may also have to pass an exam in canal history. The basin, as the Birmingham Canal Navigations booklet puts it, is a mecca for local waterways enthusiasts. Just up from the basin on the Worcester branch, the canal had started to leak. This is not, I think, unusual. The canal's basin is porous, as it is essentially puddled clay. The sides are bricks and mortar, which are forever leaking a little. However, this section sits above the railway. It was seeping into a disused tunnel, but eventually it would leak onto the main line that carries trains from Penzance to Inverness. Thus the canal was being drained to plug the leak. Initially it was decided to drain the whole basin, which would have meant moving out all the narrowboats. But at the last minute, several old narrowboat boys taught the young engineers a thing or two about canals and how you dam them. During all of this, there was plenty of talk about diamond rings. The basin is a shortcut to the bawdy strip and dance halls of Broad Street, and everyone seemed to have at least one tale of engagement rings flung into the canal. So I wasn't surprised that by now Dave had not only spent hours peering into the sludge of the drained canal, but had identified several treasures he wanted. As we walked along the towpath, spying through the barrier, he named what he saw as rightfully his. He wanted the sunglasses, the goblet that might be the Holy Grail or just a beer glass, a Victorian scuttle, a console of some sort that he was mildly obsessed with, to the extent that I have to know what it's for, and some bunny plastic ears. Apart from a very large and handsome terracotta pot that must once have been on someone's balcony, it was hard to spot anything else in the mud that one might want. There were numerous beer and gin bottles, and that seemed to be that. But it seemed important that I name at least one find if I was to come on the mission to climb down into the mud and reclaim the treasures. I stared very hard, and then I saw them. Mussel shells. "I want the mussels," I blurted out. Dave turned first to the mud and then to me. "You want the mussels?" he repeated, a little incredulous. We decided that the mussels were too big to have come from one of the canal-side restaurants, so there must be freshwater mussels. That was all the reason I needed to go down into the mud. Mudlarking is an old practice. The name comes from the urchins who used to trawl the banks of the Thames for anything they could sell. It was a bottom-rung job for 18th and 19th century children and the elderly, but it came with a certain freedom. You made your own hours in accordance with the tides, and I guess there was always the glimmer in the mud of the next find that might bring you your fortune. Today most mudlarks have a metal detector, but for one morning we'd join the ranks without, once we'd got round the barrier. It took a little rearranging, but soon we slipped down the towpath and chose a suitable spot to jump down into the canal. It is 7 or 8 feet deep, and at various times rubble has been poured into it to block suspected holes, so there were small islands between the watery mud for us to jump onto. Dave stepped gingerly into the mud. It looked firm enough and there were already some footprints in it, but that was a deception. It quickly became clear that the mud was like quicksand and far deeper than we'd imagined. We were stuck, hopping from rubble island to rubble island. The beautiful terracotta pot would remain a buried treasure. So would the Victorian coal scuttle, which disintegrated in Dave's hand as he tried to pull it up. A pair of sunglasses, the bunny ears and a frying pan were all easy pickings, so I left him poking about to go and look at the shells. Torch in one hand, I bent down to pick up the first. The mud slurped as I pulled it free. The stench of industrial silt was overpowering, rotting and metallic. The pearlescent inside of the shell gleamed, while the outside...